at all on his own. I could even tell the police that Brad and I had had sex a couple of times in the house I was building, but that I never suggested he murder my husband. It would be his word against mine, and they could never prove that I had anything to do with it. But people would know. Of course they would. I caught myself clenching my teeth and stopped doing it. I breathed through my nose, savoring the smell of gasoline while I waited for the attendant to run my credit card. The rain began, fat, intermittent drops that made snapping sounds on the roof of the car as I drove away from the gas station toward I-95. I kept worrying about Brad for most of the drive to Boston. Maybe he'd rise to the occasion when the police spoke with him. Maybe his alibi would hold up. And maybe, hopefully, the sketch that the detective had wouldn't look anything like Brad. That would be the best-case scenario. But down deep, I knew somehow that the sketch was going to look just like Brad, that he had fucked up and let someone see him. After a while, I forced myself to think of something else, and began to think about Lily Kintner, the woman who lived in Winslow, and about whom I would never be thinking if Ted hadn't gone there last Friday and gotten a parking ticket. There had been a time when Lily had been a constant and annoying presence in my life. She was 2 years behind me at Mather. I'd met her my junior year when my boyfriend, Eric Washburn, gave her an invite to St. Dunn's. "Who is she?" I'd asked. I hadn't been invited to a St. Dunn's Thursday night party until my sophomore year, and only after I'd been fucking Eric Washburn for 3 weeks. "Do you know David Kintner, the novelist?" Eric said. "No," I said. "She's his daughter." She came to that first Thursday night party, and I almost didn't see her. She was like some waif from a Victorian novel, thin and pale with long red hair. I watched her, and at first I thought she was nervous, blending into the wall she stood against with a drink in her hand, too frightened to talk with anyone. But I got closer to her, took another look, and decided that she actually didn't care that she was at St. Dunn's. She seemed almost disinterested, like a girl in the back row of a boring lecture. Did she even understand what it meant to get a skull card as a freshman? I thought she'd never return, but she kept coming back every Thursday, and it was clear that Eric had become interested. I found one of her father's books in the library and read some of it in a basement carrel. It was supposed to be a comedy, but it was mainly about boarding school boys in England being cruel to one another. It struck me as the kind of stupid book that Eric would idolize. I didn't care so much at that point, since I'd started sleeping with Matthew Ford, who made Eric look practically middle class. Senior year, Eric and Lily became a couple. I was fine with it. Matthew and I were a much better fit than Eric and I had ever been. Unlike Eric, Matthew was insecure enough to make up for it by buying me anything I wanted. I told him elaborate stories, how I came from a rich French-Canadian clan, but that my father had been disinherited for moving his family to Maine and teaching his daughter only English. Before Christmas break of that year, I told Matthew that I needed $1,000 to sneak into Montreal and visit my paternal grandmother, who was dying. He gave me the money in cash. It was a good relationship, but I didn't harbor any illusions that it would continue past our senior year of college. I assumed that the same would be true of Eric and Lily, especially since she was only a sophomore. But the more I saw them together, the more I realized that they were serious about each other. At least, Lily was serious. I could tell that much. I wasn't sure if Eric was capable of love. He was like me in that way, someone who could turn it on and turn it off. He told me once when we were together that he felt he could easily be in equal relationships with two women at the same time. I always remembered that he had said this, and reminded him of it during senior week, when our exams were done and underclassmen were still busy studying. "You suggesting something?" he asked. We were sitting on the stairwell at St. Dunn's, sharing a cigarette and listening to the remnants of a party down below. Radiohead was playing, and someone was shouting to change the music. "I don't know," I said. "Everyone thinks you and Lily are serious. What about you and Matthew?" "Over with as of graduation day." "Oh, yeah." "Look," I said, and touched his prickly jaw. "It's senior week. What do you say?" We hooked up that night and continued to hook up the rest of that summer. Eric visited Lily at her parents' place on weekends and spent the weeks with me. Lily never came to the city, and he told his group of friends that he was visiting his sick father on the weekend. As a joke, I dyed my hair red and told Eric to just pretend that he had only one girlfriend. I loved my weekends alone that summer in New York. I was subletting my own one bedroom in the village, so Saturday and Sunday were entirely my own. I imagined Eric and Lily in the country, in love, and it didn't bother me one bit. In fact, it made me laugh. Eric died that fall in London. He was visiting Lily and forgot to bring his allergy medicine. Dropped dead from eating nuts. I used to wonder what it had been like for Lily. I'd heard he died in her apartment while she watched. I imagined her frantically searching for his EpiPen, trying to keep him alive. I always thought that Lily lucked out. She only knew Eric Washburn as a faithful boyfriend. She never learned the truth about him. I ran into Lily a few years later. She wasn't on Facebook, but I'd heard rumors about her, that she was some sort of librarian at Winslow College, and something else about her father being involved in a car accident that killed his second wife. I recognized her right away. She hadn't changed at all, pale and waifish, pippy long stocking color hair in the exact same cut, blank face. I told her I was sorry about what had happened with Eric Washburn. And she stared at me for a moment with a flat, unwavering stare. That was the extent of our interaction. I tried to remember if I'd introduced her to Ted, and I think I probably did, but couldn't be sure. I did remember her cold stare, her green, almost translucent eyes. Did she know about Eric and me that summer? And if she knew, then was it a possibility that Eric hadn't accidentally died? I didn't think so. But it unnerved me somehow that she was back in my mind. There were many reasons why Ted might have gone to Winslow on Friday. The chance that it had something to do with Lily was incredibly slim. I got back to Boston at 4 in the afternoon. I parked on the street about 3 blocks from my house and went to the bar of a boutique hotel, where I drank a vodka on the rocks and ordered a plate of lobster orecchiette. I was starving. When I'd finished the pasta, I returned to my car and called Detective Kimball. He picked up immediately. "I'm in Boston," I told him. "Great," he said. "Where are you? I can pick you up if you like. Take you to the station." I told him I was just down the street from our house, parked on the street, not knowing what to do or where to go. I put a little hitch in my voice as I said it. "Understandable. If you just wait there, I can come get you. Then if you want, you can make some calls from the station. Maybe there's a friend's house you'd like to stay at or a hotel." The detective arrived 10 minutes later in a white Mercury Grand Marquis and drove me to the station. The interior of his car smelled of hand-rolled cigarettes and peppermint. He was wearing jeans and a corduroy jacket. His tie looked vintage and was frayed a little along one side. "Thank you so much for coming back to Boston," he said as he weaved through traffic, one hand on the steering wheel, the other on his knee. Index finger tapping to non-existent music. "We're feeling very good about this lead. We think we have a detailed description of the man who killed your husband." How? I asked. There was a woman visiting one of your neighbors who was sitting in her car texting. She watched a man exit from the house that was burglarized, the Bennetts at 317, you know them, and then walked to your house. She said she kept watching him because he seemed shifty and nervous. He passed right under a street lamp and she got a good look at his facial features. She worked with our sketch artist and we have a pretty good likeness, I think. The detective glanced toward me. He was smiling a little shyly, as though he wasn't sure how he should act. I watched his eyes scan my face. Why do you want me to take a look at the sketch? Do you think I might know him? We think it's a possibility. Our witness said that the suspect rang the doorbell at your house. Your husband came to the door and talked to the man for a while. In fact, the witness says she stopped watching because it seemed like they might have known each other. Next time she looked up, he wasn't there, and she assumed that he'd entered the house.
Oh, my God, I said. It was someone Ted knew?
It's just a possibility, Mrs. Severson. It's possible he was a random burglar who talked his way into your house. That's why we want you to look at the sketch.
Are you sure that this man who came to the door was the same man who shot my husband? The detective casually spun the wheel of the car and looped his way into a parking space in front of the precinct.
We think so, he said, killing the engine. The witness said she was sitting in the car sometime around 6 at night, and that's approximately the time of death that the coroner came up with. She didn't hear a gunshot, but her car was running, and your house has thick walls, or so they tell me.
I lowered my head and took a deep breath through my nostrils.
You okay? The detective asked.
I've been better. Sorry. I just need a moment. Let's go in and look at the sketch. We were quiet as Detective Kimball escorted me into the station and had us buzzed past the heavily fortified reception area into a hallway with scuffed linoleum floors and brick walls. I followed the detective to an open space area that had been carved into cubicles. I moved slowly. It was clear from what I'd heard that Brad had definitely been spotted. I controlled my rage and thought about what I needed to say to the detective. If the sketch looked remotely like him, I would need to say so. Otherwise, I would look suspicious when they did finally catch up with Brad. What I was desperately hoping for was a sketch that didn't look like him at all, so that I could honestly say that I had no idea who I was looking at. We reached the detective's desk in a cubicle framed by temporary partitions. He offered me a molded plastic chair to sit in, and he settled onto a swivel chair with a padded seat. His desk was cluttered, but the piles of folders and loose paper seemed organized into distinct towers, each topped by a post-it note in a different color. He pulled a folder off the top of one of the smaller towers and unfolded it.
"Can you see okay here?" he asked.
We were under a bright fluorescent light built into the low ceiling of polystyrene tiles, and I told him I could see fine. He slid out a piece of paper from the manila folder and twisted it so that I could see the sketch. It was a pretty good likeness of Brad. The thick neck, the black goatee, the dark eyes a little too close together under thick brows. His most distinctive feature, the thick hair and low hairline, was covered up by the baseball cap he wore. I could feel Detective Kimball's eyes on me. I could sense his giddy anticipation.
"I don't know," I said, and jutted out my lower lip, studying the sketch to give myself another few seconds. But it was too close a likeness for me not to mention it.
"You know who he looks like?" I said. "He looks like our contractor up in Maine, Brad Daggett. But Brad barely knew Ted, and he doesn't even live in Boston, so..." I sat up and looked at the detective.
"I don't know if that's helpful. Brad Daggett, the detective said. Can you spell that for me? He wrote it down. What can you tell me about him?
Not much, really. I work with him closely, but I don't know anything about him personally. I really can't imagine any reason that Brad would have for coming down to see Ted, or for actually killing him. It doesn't make any sense.
He was your contractor? Is it possible that your husband and he were having some dispute over money?
Not without my knowing about it.
I was the only one who worked closely with Brad, and I was making most of the money decisions.
No, not a chance.
So had you had any disputes with him? Any issues at all?
Small stuff here and there. Like maybe he bought the wrong ceiling molding, but nothing important. He was totally professional, and he was being paid incredibly well. There's just absolutely no reason I can think of that he would have anything against Ted.
Is he married?
Who, Brad? I don't think so.
He was married, because I'm pretty sure he has kids, but he's never mentioned a wife. And was he ever inappropriate with you? Did he ever give you the impression that he found you attractive?
He stammered a little as he said it, and seemed uncomfortable, and I wondered briefly if his nervous energy was for real, or if it was an act.
No, he might have, but if he did, he never let me know. As I said, he was totally professional.
I looked again at the sketch, impressed by how much it looked like Brad, and pissed that Brad had been stupid enough to get spotted, then added, "The more I look at it, it still looks like him, but only superficially. It's a man with a goatee, that's all."
"Okay." Kimball put his finger on the sketch and swung it back toward him. "We'll check him out. Do you have his number?"
I pulled out my phone and gave the detective Brad's number.
"I really don't think," I said. "No, no, I know. But we'll need to follow up, just to eliminate him from the investigation. My guess is that your husband's murder is exactly what it seems to be. Someone breaking into houses, looking for jewelry and other small items to steal. Maybe the killer had some sort of cover story that enabled him to talk his way into your house. Would you say that Ted was the trusting type? Would he have let a stranger past his door if that stranger had a good story?"
I thought for a moment, telling myself that the real answer was a resounding no.
"I could see that," I said. "He lived a charmed life, and nothing bad had ever happened to him. You'd think that with all the money he made, but he was pretty trusting."
Detective Kimball leaned back in his swivel chair and nodded at me. I could feel that we were winding down. It made me nervous. I knew that as soon as he was alone, the detective was going to call Brad, and I did not trust that Brad would handle that call well at all, even though we'd been over what he was going to say 100 times. I thought about trying to call him first to warn him and calm him down, then realized that there would be phone records, that the police would know I called him immediately after identifying him in a sketch.
"You know," I said, realizing that it was important that I didn't hide any information from the police, "I actually saw Brad Daggett yesterday morning. I needed to tell him to suspend work on the house. I was on my way up to Maine."
"Oh." The detective let the chair tilt forward. "He was totally normal. A little shocked, I thought, about what happened to Ted."
"Like I said, we just need to eliminate him. I'm sure he has an alibi. From what you're saying, it doesn't sound like he had anything to do with this." "Oh, one other thing, Mrs. Severson. The scene of the crime officers are done at your house, which means you're free to go back there. I didn't know if you'd..."
"I need to go back," I said. "Just to pick up some clothes
and then I'll see how I feel about staying there. Okay. He stood, and so did I. I need to stay here at the station, he said. But I can get an officer to give you a ride back to your car, or to your house. No, thanks. I can take a taxi. Well then, I'll call you a taxi. I can't thank you enough for coming in and looking at our sketch. You've been very helpful. And in my experience, once we get a likeness, an arrest is not far behind. Someone will know this guy. I continued to stand for a moment, hesitant to leave, knowing that things might start to unravel fast. My mind reeled, knowing that Brad would be questioned, probably within hours, by the police. I'd coached him, but not enough. And then there were other things, like the fact that Ted, on that last visit to Kennewick, had met up with Brad and gotten drunk with him at that bar at the beach. It was such an odd thing for Ted to do. It made me wonder about what Brad had said the day before, how he was convinced that Ted knew about us. Maybe he did, but how was that possible? And if he did, would he have told anyone? But even if he hadn't known, the fact that Brad and Ted had drinks together would only make the police more suspicious of Brad.
You okay?
Detective Kimball asked awkwardly, and I realized he'd caught me standing there, lost in thought for about 5 seconds. I dropped my shoulders, pretended to suppress a sob, then looked up at him and let tears run out of my eyes. He quickly glanced around the office, but I stepped into him, and he was forced to take me in his arms. I began to sob, pulling him in close to me, burying my head under his chin. I pressed hard enough so that I could feel my breasts flattening out against his chest.
"It's okay, Mrs. Severson," he said, and put a hand around my shoulders, keeping his other one down by his side.
I separated from him, apologizing madly, just as Detective James, his partner, a tall black woman, floated over and asked me if I needed anything.
"Just a taxi," I said. "I'm sorry. So sorry."
"Don't worry about it. I totally understand." Detective James had smoothly taken over the distraught widow and was gently but firmly leading me away from Kimball's desk. I stopped and turned.
"Oh, Detective," I said. "Remember what you asked me yesterday about whether I knew anyone from Winslow?"
He was still standing, his cell phone in one hand.
"Yeah, I remember."
"I thought of someone. Her name's Lily Kintner. I went to Mather College with her. I'm sure she has nothing to do with why Ted went out there on Friday, but..."
"Did they know one another? Were you close with her?"
"No, we weren't. She stole my boyfriend in college, actually, so I'm not a huge fan. But Ted and she didn't know... Well, they might have met a couple of times, if I think about it. I ran into Lily in Boston a couple of years ago."
"How do you spell her name?"
I told him. There was obviously no connection between Ted and Lily, but I figured it couldn't hurt to give the police another lead to track down. It might delay what now seemed inevitable, that Brad was going to get caught, and that he'd most likely give me up as well. I told Detective James that I was okay, that I'd just like to leave.
"You sure I can't get you a drink of water before you go?" she asked in her husky voice, looking down at me. I figured she was close to 6 feet tall.
She must have been a little bit self-conscious about it, because every time I'd seen her, she was wearing flats. Dark pantsuit, collared shirt, and flats. And she never wore jewelry. She made me nervous in a way that Detective Kimball didn't. It wasn't that I thought she suspected me. It was that I truly had no idea what she was thinking. She looked at me the way she might look at a toll booth collector.
"Can I walk you out, Mrs. Severson?"
"No, I'm fine. And it's Miranda." She nodded at me and turned away. I was pretty sure she didn't wear any makeup either. Detective Kimball must have made a call, because when I got to the front of the station, a taxi was waiting. It was already dusk, rain beginning. It felt as though the bad weather had followed me all the way down from my mother's house.
Chapter 22 Lily. I checked out of the Kennewick Inn very early on Tuesday morning, figuring I could drive directly to Winslow College. It didn't make sense to miss another day of work and draw attention to myself. I'd drunk 2 cups of coffee at the inn, but stopped in Kittery at a Dunkin' Donuts for another coffee to go. I was exhausted. Brad and I had talked for several hours the night before, first in his truck, then in the rental cottage that he lived in. Despite what he'd done to Ted, I felt a little bad for Brad. He was a wreck, and once he realized that I wasn't going to turn him in, he latched onto me like a drowning man coming across a lifeboat. He told me he would set up the meeting with Miranda for that night at 10 p.m. If she agreed, he would call me at my house from the public phone at Cooley's. He would only let the phone ring twice, but the number would appear on the digital readout on my landline. I made it into my office before anyone else arrived. After logging into my work email account, I wasn't surprised to learn that my boss, Otto, had left early on Monday, the previous afternoon, having felt a cough coming on himself, and that he thought he'd take Tuesday off as well. Otto Lemke was easily the most suggestible man alive, especially when it came to any kind of ailment. Just letting him know on Sunday that I wasn't feeling well had probably sent him into a spiral of psychosomatic illness. I spent the morning writing short descriptions of our archived collections to go on our internal site for students and faculty. When I'd done enough to justify a morning's worth of work, I walked across campus to the student-run cafe where I got most of my lunches. The rainstorm from the previous day had left the world looking bright and washed, like a car emerging from a car wash. The cloudless sky was a deep, metallic blue. The air was crisp and smelled of apples. At the cafe, I got curried tuna salad on wheat and took my sandwich out to one of the stone benches with a view of the line of oak trees, bright red and bristling in the high breeze, that split Winslow's main quad. My life was good, and I wondered briefly why I'd gotten involved in the sordid affairs of Miranda and Ted and Brad. What I was planning on doing in Kennewick tomorrow night was a huge risk. It was dependent on Brad, who was so fragile you could almost see the cracks in him. And it was also dependent on Miranda's not becoming suspicious when Brad suggested the meeting. I felt exposed, and less than 100% confident, but knew that I had gone this far, and would go to the end. Ted deserved to be avenged, and Miranda deserved to be punished, now more than ever. That afternoon, I had scheduled an off-site visit to a former student, now in her 80s, who was offering to donate items from her school years to the archives. These visits were often the best part of my job, and sometimes the worst. It all depended on the lucidity and expectations of the former student or professor. Sometimes, all they had were a few battered textbooks and some class notes. These were often lonely people looking for someone to talk with for a while. Someone who would have to listen to long tales from their college days. Sometimes, however, these former students would turn out to have treasure troves of archival materials. These were the girls who kept everything. The printed menus from the midwinter formal of 1935. Photographs from the March blizzard of 1960, when the drifts of snow were 7 feet high. A handwritten poem from when May Gillis was the visiting writer. I never knew what to expect with these visits, and I only scheduled them when the person was within close driving distance. Otherwise, we would ask the donors to mail us their materials. I nearly canceled that afternoon's visit. I was still tired from lack of sleep, and was not sure that I had it in me to accompany some stranger down her own personal memory lane. But I told myself that I should keep my schedule as normal as possible. So I went, driving several towns west to Greenfield, where Prudence Walker, class of 1958, lived. She was raking leaves when I arrived and had filled several bags, all of which had already been placed on her curb for pickup. Her house was a neat, orderly Cape Cod in a neighborhood of colonials and deck houses. I pulled into her driveway behind a new model Camry, and Prudence Walker put down her rake and came over to greet me. "Hello there. Thank you so much for coming out. You've done an old lady a huge favor." She was wearing a faded denim skirt and a green windbreaker. Her gray hair was pulled back in a bun. "It's not a problem," I said, getting out of my car. "It's all boxed up and right there on the front step. I'd carry it over to you, but it took all I had to get it from the attic to where it's sitting. Apparently, back then, I decided I needed to keep everything. Most of it's my scrapbooks, but I included all my notes from class and syllabi. And there's a bunch of exam papers as well. You said you wanted those, didn't you?" "I'll take it all. Thank you again for this." I walked over to the front step and picked up the heavy box. Prudence Walker came with me, walking with an uneven gait that dipped her right shoulder down every time she took a step with her right leg. "I hate to make you drive all the way out here, then send you off just like that, but I'm trying to get all these leaves raked up before we lose the sun. Can I get you a glass of water or anything?" "No, thanks," I said, loading the box into my trunk. As I backed out of the driveway, I watched her walk unsteadily back to the rake she had left leaning against a maple tree. I felt a surge of love for this woman, so willing to discard her old life, to not look back. But really, I was just grateful that I didn't need to sit for an entire afternoon going through scrapbooks. I dropped the box back at Winslow, answered a few more emails, then drove to my house, a cottage-style two-bedroom built in 1915. It overlooked a picturesque pond, lousy for swimming. It bred mosquitoes all summer, but decent for ice skating in the cold winter months. I checked my phone, and there was no call yet from Cooley's. My doctor's office had called to remind me of an appointment, and my mother had called but had not left a message. It wasn't yet 5 o'clock, and I thought I'd try to take a short nap before making dinner. I lay down on the couch in my living room, and just as I was falling into a light sleep, the doorbell chimed and I jerked upright, confused for a second about where I was. I ran my fingers through my hair, stood, and walked to the foyer. I peered through the leaded glass that ran along the side of the front door. A slightly shaggy-looking man in his 30s stood there, scratching at the back of his neck. I partially opened the door, keeping the chain on. "Can I help you?" I said. "Are you Lily Kintner?" said the man, pulling his wallet out of his herringbone tweed jacket. Before I had a chance to answer, he flipped the wallet open to show a Boston PD detective badge. "I'm Detective Kimball. Do you mind if I have a quick word?" I unchained the door and swung it open. He scraped his feet on my welcome mat and stepped inside the house.
"I like this house," he said, glancing around.
"Thank you. What can I help you with? You've got me curious." I took a few slow steps into the living room, and he followed me.
"Well, your name has come up in an investigation, and I have a few questions. Do you have a moment?"
I offered him the red leather club chair, and he perched on its edge. I sat down on the couch. I was scared to hear what he was about to say, but also anxious to hear it.
"What can you tell me about Ted Severson?"
"That man who was killed in Boston over the weekend?"
"Uh-huh."
"I can tell you what I read in the newspaper, but that's about all. I do have a vague connection with him, but I don't know him. He was married to someone I went to school with."
"You went to school with Miranda Severson?"
The detective pulled a notebook from his coat and flipped it open. He pulled a small nub of a pencil from its spiral binding. "Yes, Mather College. She was Miranda Hobart then. Faith Hobart, actually." She went by a different name. Faith is her middle name, I think. That's what she went by in college.
Have you kept up with her? How did you know that Ted Severson and she were married?
He sat up a little, pushing back fractionally into the chair. His hair was a little long, especially for a police detective. He had round, brown eyes under thick eyebrows, an imposing nose, and a mouth that could belong to a girl with a plump lower lip. We met in Boston a few years ago, just by accident.
Was she with her husband then?
You know, I was wondering that myself after I read the story. She was with a man, I think, and she introduced us, but I don't remember much about him. I couldn't believe it when I read about what happened in Boston. Detective, is it Kimball? I was going to make coffee. Should I make enough for two? I stood, aware that I was potentially acting suspicious, but I needed time to think.
Sure, if you're going to make it for yourself.
Unless you think we can wrap this up right away. I'm actually pretty curious as to why you're here, I said as I walked toward the kitchen.
No, make coffee and I'd love some.
Once in the kitchen, I took a deep breath, put the water on to boil, and put ground coffee at the bottom of my French coffee press. I needed to think clearly. Something had happened to connect me with Ted Severson, and I had to be extremely careful to not get caught in a lie, not to contradict myself. They had found something out, but I didn't know how much. When the water had started to boil, I poured it over the coffee, inserted the plunger. I put the coffee on a tray with two mugs, a carton of milk, and a bowl of sugar cubes, and brought it back into the living room. I was startled to see the detective standing, peering closely at the bindings in my living room's built-in bookshelf.
Sorry, he said, sitting back down on the lip of the chair. You have some interesting books. I hope you don't mind my asking. You're David Kintner's daughter, right?
I placed the tray on the coffee table and sat down on the couch. Yes. Do you know him? And please, just help yourself to coffee.
I do know him. I've read several of his books, and I saw him read once, in Durham, New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah?
He was quite the showman.
So I've heard. I've never seen him read before.
Really? I'm surprised.
Don't be. He's my father, and what he does for work is not exactly fascinating to me. At least, it wasn't when I was younger. I watched the detective assemble his coffee, adding milk but no sugar. He had beautiful hands with long, slender fingers. I was suddenly struck with how similar he looked to Eric Washburn. Thin and masculine, but with almost girlish facial features. Rosebud mouth, thick eyelashes. He took a sip of his coffee, put the mug back on the coffee table, and said,
"You know, you weren't easy to find out here. Are you still a Kintner, or did you officially change your name to Lily Hayward?"
"No, I'm still Kintner, legally. People here know me as Lily Hayward. Hayward was my father's mother's maiden name. Don't read too much into it. It's just that, working at a college, people are familiar with my father and all his baggage, and when I got the job here, I decided to go by another name."
"Understandable."
"So you know what's happening with my father?"
"The accident in England."
"Right."
"Yes, I heard about it. I'm sorry. I really am a big fan of your father's. I've read all his books, actually. I think I remember that he dedicated his last one to you."
"He did. Too bad it wasn't a better book." The detective smiled.
"It wasn't so bad. I think the reviews were a little harsh."
He took another sip of his coffee, was quiet for a moment. "So," I said, "back to Ted Severson. I'm still confused why you're here."
"Well, it could all be a coincidence, of course, but Ted Severson came here to Winslow on the day he was killed. We know that because he got a parking ticket. He wasn't coming to see you by any chance."
A flash of anger at Ted's stupidity went through me, followed by a touch of sadness. He had come looking for me. He had come to my town. I shook my head. Like I said, I don't know him, and he doesn't know me. We might have met once or twice.
You were in England in September, right?
I was. I went over to see my father after he got out of prison. In fact, he's going to be moving back to America, and I was there to help him with some of the logistics.
Do you remember the flight you took back?
I can look it up for you if you'd like.
That's okay, I know the flight. It was the same one that Ted Severson was on after a business trip he took to the UK. Do you remember seeing him on that flight?
I was prepared for this. So they knew that Ted and I were on a flight together. It was still highly doubtful that they knew that Ted and I met later at the Concord River Inn. Did they know I traveled to Kennewick the day before? Probably not, but it wouldn't be hard to find out.
Do you have a picture of him?
I asked.
I don't with me, but if you have internet.
Right, I'll double-check it. But I did talk with a man on that flight. And now that I think of it, it was probably Ted Severson. We met actually in the airport bar at Heathrow. I remember thinking when we met that he seemed to know me, the way he said hello, but then we introduced ourselves and talked for a while. He didn't really look familiar to me.
You didn't exchange names?
We did, but I didn't really catch his. Or, if I did, I didn't remember it.
But you gave him your name.
I did, and I told him that I worked here in Winslow.
So if he wanted to, he could have looked you up, come out here to try and find you?
In theory, I said. Though if he'd really wanted to get in touch with me, I don't know why he wouldn't have tried to call me.
You gave him your number?
I didn't, actually.
So it's possible he tried to find your number and couldn't, then drove out here.
Sure, I guess it is. It just doesn't seem likely. We had a nice conversation, but it wasn't flirtatious, and he's a married man, and...
The detective smiled and shrugged. You might have just missed it. We see it all the time. Some guy meets some woman, and the woman thinks nothing of it, and the next thing she knows, he's stalking her. And vice versa as well, but that's not as common.
You think I was being stalked?
I have no idea. We were just curious as to why he drove out here on the day he was killed. It's a suspicious death, so we look at anything that happened recently that seems out of the ordinary. But if he drove out here in the hopes of running into you, then I can't imagine it had anything to do with his death.
No, I can't imagine.
Do you mind my asking if you're in a relationship, Miss Kintner?
No, I don't mind, and no, I'm not seeing anyone. And you can call me Lily.
Just checking, Lily. No jealous ex-boyfriends in your life?
Not that I know of.
The detective looked at his spiral-bound notebook and was quiet for a moment.
I had relaxed. As far as I could figure, I had covered myself as best I could.
I couldn't deny having met Ted on the plane. There were witnesses.
But there was no reason for me to admit anything else. If the police figured out that I had stayed for 2 nights in Kennewick immediately after the murder, I would just have to claim it was coincidence. It might look strange, but what could happen to me? It's not as though I had actually been involved in the Friday night murder.
Sorry, Lily, but I need to ask this. Can you tell me where you were on Friday evening?
I was here. I was alone. I cooked dinner for myself, then watched a movie.
Anyone stop by? Anyone call?
Sorry, no, I don't think so.
That's okay.
He finished his coffee and stood.
Is it possible to look at a picture of Ted Severson online so you can give a proper identification?
He asked. Of course, I said, and got my laptop. Together we found a picture that accompanied a news article on Ted's slaying, and I said that, yes, I was pretty sure that it was the same man I'd talked with on the plane. It's so strange, I said. I read the article and realized that I kind of knew this man, or at least I definitely knew his wife, and it turns out I'd met him recently, spoken with him. At the door, Detective Kimball reached into his jacket pocket, then said, "Oh, one more thing I nearly forgot." He pulled out a single key, still shiny.
"Do you mind if I check and see if this key opens your door?"
I laughed. So dramatic. You think this man had a key to my house? No, I don't. But we found it hidden among his things, and I need to check every possibility. I'm just eliminating your house is all. No, please check. I understand. It must have been the key that Ted had stolen from Brad's house, probably a master for all the rental cottages. If Brad became a suspect, it would only be a matter of time until they discovered that the key belonged to him. I watched the detective insert the key into my front door lock. It slid in easily, and for one confused and terrifying moment, I thought the key might turn my lock. That maybe Ted really did have a key to my house for some reason. But it didn't. The detective jiggled it a couple of times, then pulled it out. Nope, he said. I had to check, though. You've been very helpful. If you think of anything else... He held out a card, and I took it. Glancing down, I saw that his first name was Henry. I stood in the door and watched him drive away. It was almost dark, the sky crisscrossed with orange clouds. Behind me, the phone rang twice, and then stopped. I walked toward it, but I knew what the handset would tell me. I picked it up, the words missed call and the number on the digital readout. The area code was 207. I would double-check the number against the number of Cooley's payphone that I jotted down on the back of the napkin, but I was pretty sure they would be the same. The phone call meant that Brad had set up the meeting with Miranda for later that night. It was all going as planned. The visit from the detective had made me a little nervous, but, as he'd said, he was simply eliminating me from the investigation. I opened the fridge and peered inside, deciding what to make for dinner.
Chapter 23 Miranda. Back when Brad and I had been planning Ted's murder, I had briefly considered getting a pair of untraceable temporary cell phones, just in case. I had stupidly discarded that idea, not wanting any physical evidence that pointed to our guilt. Right now, I desperately wished we had them. I was pacing the house in the South End, going out of my fucking mind, wondering if I should just call Brad, warn him that he was going to be questioned. I didn't even know if it would help. Maybe he would panic more if he knew they were coming. And part of me wondered if I should tell Brad that he was recognized by a witness and that he should pack his truck and leave town, go on the run. Scenarios unfolded in my mind. According to your cell phone records, Mrs. Severson, after you identified Brad Daggett as the man who had been spotted entering your house, you called the same Mr. Daggett that evening. And now we can't find him. What exactly did you talk about during that 10-minute conversation? I'd tell them that I'd called Brad to let him know that the police might question him, that I'd identified a suspect as possibly looking like him. I told him not to worry, that no one really thought he was involved. I had no idea, Detective. I mean, why would I? You'll be glad to hear, Mrs. Severson, that we caught Brad Daggett this morning. He didn't get far, actually. They got him at the Canadian border. He's confessed to murdering your husband, and he has quite the story to go with it. Would you mind coming into the station for questioning? No. Brad running was not an option. He needed to hold his nerve, long enough for the investigation to become cold. I had plans for Brad eventually, but those plans needed to wait. I stood in front of the wide window in the second-floor living room. It was dark outside, the rain steady, almost comforting. Across the street were the lighted rooms of my neighbor's brownstones. I saw a figure move across one of them, a curtain being pulled. I stood at the window for a while. I had yet to turn on any lights in my home, and I felt invisible, looking out at my corner of the city. A car moved slowly down the street, hitting a pothole and sending a cresting spray of rain onto the sidewalk. Would the police be watching me yet? Was I a suspect? It was Monday. The murder had happened on Friday, and no one had been arrested yet. They must be getting nervous, and I knew that on one level, I would have to be a suspect. I was the wife of a rich man who had died a suspicious death. But was it more than that? I pulled the curtains across the window, making sure they met in the middle, then snapped on a lamp. It sent a circle of pale light into the room. I blinked rapidly, then shut the lamp off. I lay down on the couch in the dark, wondering if it had been a mistake to return to my house. Maybe I'd have been better off in a hotel room, like that baby-faced detective had suggested. I kept imagining Brad at the moment when a detective approached him with questions about where he had been on Friday night. I pictured him sweaty and stammering, the detective instantly suspicious. I knew that the wheels would come off fast. I'd misjudged Brad. When we'd first met, all I saw was a cocky, slightly stupid contractor. Seducing him had been way too easy. I'd waited until we were alone in the house. I bummed a cigarette, telling Brad not to tell my husband. "Hey," he'd said, "I won't tell your husband anything you don't want me to tell him." It was early August, and I was wearing a short dress that buttoned up the front. I pulled it over the top of my head, shucked my underpants, and slid on top of the finished kitchen counter. The height had been all wrong, and Brad had to slide a box of tiles over and stand on them. It was awkward and unsatisfying, but afterward I lied and told Brad, tears in my eyes, that it was the first time I'd had sex since the week after my wedding, that my husband had no interest in me that way. We got dressed, and I cried for a while, and then we got undressed again, and had sex with Brad sitting on one of the folding chairs the crew had brought in for their lunch breaks. I straddled him, facing forward, my leg muscles shaking. The look on Brad's face, his eyes raking over me, told me all I needed to know. "Never anywhere else," I said that afternoon. "Only here, and only when we absolutely know that no one will be showing up. Okay?"
"Okay," he said.
"You tell anyone about this."
"I won't."
A week later, I told him that sometimes I dreamed about killing my husband. 2 weeks later, Brad told me he'd do it for me if I wanted. It was that easy. I told him if we did it right and made no mistakes, that no one would suspect either of us, and we'd be able to marry, buy a yacht, take a year-long honeymoon. When I'd mentioned the yacht, Brad's eyes had lit up in a way I'd never seen, even when we were having sex. Sex had hooked him, but greed would keep him, and I had thought all along that he would hold his nerve. But now I wasn't so sure. I got off the couch, shook my arms out, bounced up and down a couple of times on the balls of my feet. My skin was crawling, my mind racing. I poured myself some Kettle One on ice and wandered through the dark house. There was a stain on the second floor landing where Ted had bled out. The police had told me about it, so I wouldn't be shocked. I touched it with my bare toe, a dark brown pool that almost matched the stain of the wooden floor. The cleaning service was coming tomorrow, and I would make sure to tell them about it. I brought my drink into the media room and flipped through channels for a while, settling on Pretty Woman, my favorite film from when I was a young girl. It had been on television all the time then as well, and I'd loved it. Years before I even understood what a prostitute was. It seemed stupid now, but I watched anyway, saying the lines to myself before they said them on TV. I calmed down, and when the film was over and my drink finished, I knew that I needed to drive back to Maine and talk with Brad. He needed to be prepared for what was coming, and I felt that if I had a little time with him, it could make a difference. My car was on the street instead of in the garage. I dressed in jeans and a dark green sweatshirt with a hood and left the house.
Walking to my car through the rain, I resisted the urge to look around, to see if somehow I was being watched. I didn't think I was. My car was parked at the corner of my street. I got in, pulled straight out of the spot, and drove toward I-93. The roads were quiet, and it didn't seem as though anyone was behind me, any lights suddenly appearing. I merged onto the highway, still feeling sure that I wasn't being followed. I settled into a middle lane, slid a CD into the player, and tried to relax. The rain-shiny highway unspooled in front of me. It was late by the time I reached Crescent Cottages, the steady rain now a drizzle. Brad's truck was not in front of his unit. I assumed he was at Cooley's, but I'd wait him out. It meant he'd be hammered when I finally got a chance to talk with him, but I hoped he wouldn't be so far gone that nothing would sink in. My plan was to prep him for being questioned, make sure he knew what he was going to say, then drive back to Boston before daylight. I parked my car across the road, under an oak tree, its branches lowered by the rain, and waited. I didn't have to wait long. Brad's truck slid into his spot in front of his unit about 11 p.m. I'd cracked my window, but even so, the inside of the Mini had steamed up while I waited, and Brad's truck was a blur. I rolled my window all the way down and watched as another car, a boxy Honda maybe, slid in next to Brad. Fuck, I thought. Probably Polly. I watched as first Brad, then a tall, slender woman, got out of their respective cars. Brad held the door open, and the woman entered his cottage first. She wore some kind of slick, reflective jacket and tight jeans. Way too thin to be Polly, and way too steady on her feet. Brad followed. Something about the way they entered the house made me think this wasn't a typical pickup. They'd moved like businessmen entering a meeting room. I waited 5 minutes, then pulled my hood up over my head and got out of my car. I thought it was still raining, but it was just the oak tree, rain dropping from its few remaining leaves. I crossed the road and approached Brad's cottage. I'd never been inside, but I'd stood in the doorway once, months ago, delivering blueprints, back before Brad and I had become involved. I remembered noticing how neat it was, and how sterile. I crept toward a window that was to the left of the front door. There were slatted blinds, but the way the interior light was coming through made me think I could see through them. I wanted to see if I recognized the woman. I was almost at the window when a light mounted above the door turned on, harsh white light flooding the front of the house. I moved fast around toward the side, my sneakers crunching on the crushed shell driveway. I pressed my back against the wooden siding where the shadows were the darkest and waited for the exterior light to extinguish itself. It did, after a very long minute. I heard no one stirring inside the house, and the road remained quiet. There was one window on the side of the house, just low enough that I could look through it while standing on tiptoe. The blinds were closed, but there was a little space between them, and I could see through into a kitchen, a white refrigerator, an empty countertop, and beyond that, into the living area, where Brad and a woman with red hair sat talking on the couch. In front of them, on the coffee table, sat two bottles of beer. For one brief moment, I thought it was Lily Kintner from Mather, and a shiver went through me. But the woman moved her head a little, and I decided it wasn't Lily. She wore cheap makeup, dark eyeliner, and bright lipstick, and unless Lily had changed, she was not the type to wear makeup at all. I watched for a while, Brad and this woman talking intently, and I couldn't for the life of me figure out what they must be talking about. Brad seemed beaten down, his shoulders slumped, his mouth hanging open. The woman, whoever she was doing most of the talking. Brad looked like a dumb student trying to follow what his teacher was saying.
This was not what I had expected to see at all. I expected to see Brad and some slut from